You're mad at me, aren't you? You're mad because I shot your girlfriend's dog.
It wasn't her dog. It was her husband. Who said anything about a girlfriend? Okay, James, I wish you hadn't shot my girlfriend's dog. Even though Poe and I were not exactly what you'd call simpatico, that's no reason he should take two in the chest.
Today on Real Lit, we'll be fishing 2,611 pages of Grady Tripp's book out of the Monongahela, because we're analyzing the 1995 Michael Chabon novel and 2000 Curtis Hanson film Wonder Boys.
Monongahela.
Monongahela.
It's all right.
Maybe I'm just bad.
Oh, Monongahela.
Monongahela.
Very complicated. Why couldn't it have been the Ohio River? It flows through Pittsburgh as well.
Yeah, what the heck, Chabon?
Welcome to Real Lit. I'm Steven.
And I'm Mackenzie.
Wow, it's good to be back in the studio, huh?
It is good to be back. You know, we, of course, technology rebelled against us. It was upset at our absence.
Yeah, this I hope podcast is not cursed like Grady Tripp's book. But it's taken us a while to get set up. But we'll see where we can go from that. Not to mention this crazy thing, you know, going back, semester starting.
School.
Doesn't it suck? They expect us to, like, teach and stuff. I mean, I'm a podcaster.
Yeah, my students, they listen to podcasts all summer. And now they're coming in. And I'm trying to treat my class a little bit like a podcast now.
Hey. Still a lot of this stuff that we do research on. Might as well bring it in the classroom. I'm excited about today's selection because this is a book that I read. I'm going to show my age here. I believe I was a sophomore in college. So I would have read it in 97 or 98, just a few years after this book came out. 2000, the film came out. I was in the theater, saw it, loved it. Bought it on DVD, loaned it to a friend, never got it back. Bought it again on DVD. My ex-girlfriend stole it when I broke up.
Oh, no.
So the DVD that you watch is my third edition of that. And I'm pretty sure I've been through three or four copies of the book as well.
And this was my first time. I had never even really heard of the title before you had mentioned it. And I'm so glad because I really loved both the book and the film. And this was my first time with both. And they're so similar, which I love. I love it when film adaptations follow closely to the written work.
And this is pretty darn close. There are some differences, and some of these even are very similarly different, if that makes sense. For instance, Grady Tripp's breakout novel in the film is called The Arsonist's Daughter, and it's, what is it, The Land Downstairs?
Yes.
In the book, but he has a second novel that came out before the breakout, which was called The Arsonist's Girl. I think The Arsonist's Daughter does have a little bit more of a ring to it.
Yeah. And then the dog. You know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, and in the film, the dog's name is Poe, and that's kind of in-your-face obvious, right? A famous literary author, Poe, and then in the book, it's Dr. D, and I didn't make a connection of that at first, but then when we were talking about it, you found the Fantastic Four reference.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's Dr. Doom. Chabon is a huge comic book nerd, so he's kind of my guy. Emily, the ex-wife, the wife who leaves Grady in the book, works at Richards Reads Publishing, which is Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic. They work in the Baxter Building, which is where the Fantastic Four are located in Marvel. So I'm pretty sure that's another one of those sly Fantastic Four nods. What else? I mean, these others are so minor. The Galaxy, it is in both of them, a 1966 Ford Galaxy 500, but it's green in the novel for some reason, not maroon. Speaking of green, Hannah Green is blonde.
Yeah.
Sarah Gaskell is kind of portly and redheaded with freckles. I think some of the physical descriptions are probably just changed because they knew who they wanted to cast. You know, they wanted Katie Holmes, they wanted Frances McDormand, and they just don't look like that.
Right. And then even a lot of weird moments like the tuba, you know.
That would be a tuba.
The tuba is so random. I loved when the case came up at the airport. I was like, really? But it was just kind of an iconic image to keep with you throughout the film, too. And the recounting of the story of Vernon Hardapple. You do?
I do. You know, my friends and I, after we saw the film, we used to just, sometimes we'd be sitting in a bar or in a restaurant somewhere, and we'd see like somebody strange out there, and we're like, oh, let's go. We're going to do the tripping crab apple thing. We even called it that.
I loved the jumping on the hood of the car. It was so funny. It was so random. He bowed. Oh, I loved that.
Somebody jumped on your car with their butt. Yeah, but I mean, there's so much other things. Even some of the phrases. Like, that's just what the ads used to say, speaking of the trunk and the tuba. The Crabtree Pharmacopoeia, one of those very specific phrases, that's in there as well. The way Lear lists the alphabetical order of all the Hollywood suicides, That's straight out of the book. So it is very, very close.
And the book does drive home a few points stronger than the film. Of course, when you have more pages to write, I feel like that accounts for a lot of the description.
And you get Grady's inner monologue. It's a yes. Close first person, but at least you get what he's thinking sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. And I definitely think that first person point of view, I mean, it's just hard to replace.
Do you want to just go ahead and get it up in the open? Grady in the book is a slight bit of a creep.
Yeah.
Speaking of Hannah Green.
He is.
I do love in the film, you know, I mean, he's not a nice guy. Grady's got all kinds of issues. Still root for him, but he's almost like anti-hero level. But the one thing that he does, he consistently rebuffs Hannah Green when she comes on to him. Mm-hmm. And in the book, he still does. Like, he never goes to bed with her or anything, but he's noticed. He's having thoughts about how good looking she is, and he's being tempted.
And I mean, it mentions, right, that his current wife that just left him is a little bit younger.
Yeah.
Than he is.
Yeah, and again, the book is 1995. You're a lot younger than I am. I mean, I went to grad school in the early 2000s when this film would have come out, and everybody knew somebody who was having a fling with one of the professors. It just, not all professors, but there was always that one and always that one graduate student. So it was almost like expected.
Playing on a trope.
Yeah, exactly. And it's worth noting that there, right around this time, a bunch of books that come out about professors and students having affairs, like Francine Prose's Blue Angel. That's a very good book. And I like the fact that even though Grady in the book thought about it, it does kind of subvert that trope, and that he's finally like, you know what, I can't do this.
Yeah. And I do like that the book, there's a little bit more explanation to Sarah's being unable to have a child.
Right.
We don't really get a lot of prelude to that in the movie. And again, time, of course, you have to be more conscious of it in a film. But I do like that we get more context to that.
It's almost like when she gets angry at him, she's like, you don't know what it's like. I'm not going to repeat everything she says, but you're kind of like, wow, that's really intense. But You understand, if she's had trouble conceiving In the book, you understand why she's so upset that, you know, that's even on the table, that maybe that we're not going to have this child. That's makes more sense when you kind of put that into the book and understand what's going on there. Speaking of which, I got it, but I hear a lot of people saying they didn't understand that when James Lear is standing out by the greenhouse twirling that cap gun at the beginning of the film, that he's thinking about taking his own life. Mm-hmm. And I always thought it made sense to me, but it clearly says it in the book. Like,
yeah,
he definitely was suicidal at that point.
No, yeah, I agree. In the film, I got that idea, not just because of how he was acting, but the darkness surrounding him, right? The shadow, all of the
chiaroscuro.
Yeah, the external factors, you know, that just contribute to making you feel like this is a bad space that he's in.
And he even talks about heaven on the greenhouse. Yeah. It was obvious to me. I don't know. Maybe subtlety is not what every moviegoer likes. But.
And I'm glad Grady went out there, obviously, because who knows what would have happened.
And it makes it all the more urgent that Grady's spending time with him. Even when he sends him home, you know, that's the other thing is he snaps. He's like, oh, yeah, it clicks. He and Crabtree realize we got to go save James Lear.
Right.
And that's part of it as well. They know that he's suicidal.
Yeah. And thinking about the kind of intricacy of these characters, I'm going to go into my close read, focusing mostly on the book, even though, again, both are very similar. So if you do read the book or watch the film, you'll notice how much the filmmakers really took into account every detail in the book in a lot of ways. And I want to take a look at the idea of duality in this text. And duality is often a motivating factor for a theme. Sometimes, whether it be written, in film, duality we just see a lot, and often physically representing a metaphorical meaning through the use of twins, or less commonly, doppelgangers. You know, I feel like we see a lot of duality represented in twins, in TV shows, and media. But this idea of a doppelganger in literature, you know, this is typically a reflection of whatever the main target is. And doppelganger is a Germanic in origin, meaning literally double goer or double walker. And so this concept typically manifests in an exact physical replica of a person or a symbolic representation of internal conflicts, pushing a focus on identity and human nature overall. And Grady explains his perspective that, quote, Q had become his own doppelganger, a malignant shadow who lived in the mirrors and under the floorboards and behind the drapes of his own existence, end quote. In that Q himself termed this idea of, quote, midnight disease, where your other, darker self eventually overtakes the original you until you actually crave that separateness and that apartness that your darker self feels. And there are a few interesting concepts in these ideas that Grady presents about Q specifically. And one of the first thoughts I had was how interesting it is to call someone a doppel of themselves. Typically, someone might describe this as having multiple personalities or seeming out of character for a person. But this term, doppelganger, provides specific literary emphasis on the severity of Q's duality in human nature. Not only that, but the following diction of malignant shadow, drapes, midnight, and disease. I mean, these build upon Grady's assessment that someone can grow another darker self inside their very nature. The imagery of the mirror is also a more obvious trope of the concept of duality in a person, but bringing up this image was a great move by the author, in my opinion, because it ground these abstract thoughts into a very physical, universal object. Everyone can recognize a mirror and mirror representing duality. Although Grady seems to be oblivious to how his observations also apply to his life. You know, he has all of these great introspective thoughts regarding other people, but he doesn't realize how subconsciously he's calling himself out. Like, Grady is constantly wrestling with his past successes, his present writer's block, and seemingly chaotic future. Like, this inevitable unknown where he feels like his future is just destined for almost nothingness. And I think he sees much of himself, or who he used to be, in James. And that's why he begins to feel so connected to James in his writing career. It's as if he wants James to be his metaphorical doppelganger, in a sense. And I do think he genuinely cares about him. I do think he genuinely wants to help this student. But as time progresses, he starts to see James also as an outlet for the success that he desires. But at the same time, Grady often pushes him away because James also reminds him of his past ambitions, success, and identity. Even Grady's students see him in two completely different perspectives. Hannah describes Grady's novel as tragic and beautiful, telling Grady, quote, I love the way you write. It's so natural. It's so plain. I was thinking it's like all your sentences seem as if they've always existed, waiting around up there in style heaven or wherever for you to fetch them down, end quote. Which is truly a beautiful description. I just think that is such high praise if a student were to tell me.
It's also almost verbatim in the film when they're dancing at the hi-hat.
Yes.
Another one of those lines is just directly lifted.
And I think she says it so well in the film, her tone and her flow.
Well, she's flirting too.
Yes, yes. It's a little romantic. But the sentences are romantic, just thinking that almost as if his writing is ethereal or omnipresent. It's just very interesting diction to use there to make it so purposeful. But James, he describes Grady's life as having a heart that, quote, beat now only because it could, end quote. And so James kind of sees Grady as stagnant, doesn't have anything more to give, is just living for the sake of living. And again, diction here really is the key to analyzing this duality. Hannah describes Grady's writing as if it has always existed, waiting, plain, and natural. Or in other words, he was writing now only because he could. His writing inspired, but he was uninspired. The success of his writing that he thought would turn his life to meaning actually made him question all his priorities in life. He had entered the midnight shadow that Q had described, and he could also climb out of his darker self by letting go of trying to make a future out of the past. Even the past and future work a lot of times as dual entities in some ways. They are entirely separate. They're supposed to be complete opposites, but we try sometimes to make them the same. And I'm glad that Grady eventually found his true purpose and identity at the end of the story, you know, that he figured out what it was that truly was going to give his life meaning instead of clinging to the notions he's always had that meant he had purpose. Because sometimes you just have to be open to where your life is heading instead of thinking it has to be on a fixed path.
You know, I knew when I was going back and rereading this and I saw the Q and the doppelganger thing right at the beginning. He's giving a speech, right?
Yeah.
The word fist speech is very different. And that is one thing that does differ in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about the doppelganger in literature. And the minute I saw that, I'm like, I know what Mackenzie's going to do. You love the doppelganger.
I love it. I love dual personalities.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about duality as well in a bit of a different way for the close read of the film. First of all, I need to mention I'm a longtime fan of this director, Curtis Hanson. He's wonderful. Sure, everybody knows L.A. Confidential, one of the best films ever made. I love it as well. Surprisingly, 8 Mile with Eminem is a very good film. I was shocked.
I've not seen it.
It's worth watching. I've always been enthralled by his direction. I mean, he's got some less than remarkable titles. He did The Hand That Rocks the Cradle or Bad Influence, if you know that one with Rob Lowe and James Spader from the 80s. They're not good, but they're not necessarily bad. But even in those, I can kind of see how the director's working. So some of his camera angles, some of the mise-en-scene, I think sets up a few scenes that I want to look at and compare. I should point out, I'm going to talk a little bit about plot as well. So we do need to give a nod to Steve Kloves, give him a little nod. And just as a side note, he wrote all 7 of the Harry Potter films, as well as one of the Fantastic Beasts. And then, of course, the screenplay follows the book so closely that we'll give Michael Chabon a nod here as well. Throughout the course of the film, even though Grady thinks it sounds like a Tennessee Williams play, it's another one of my favorite lines, he has these 3 spells, we'll put that in air quotes for lack of a better term, and then almost has a 4th. There seems to be a suggestion these are seizures, particularly when James says, I thought you were going to swallow your tongue during the second one. Whatever the case, there are strong parallels in each of these 3, which leads to strong reinforcement of this theme of when he overcomes them and he does not fall. Specifically, we'll look at the proximities here. There's a proximity or a reminder of some sort in each of these of Grady's sprawling novel that's just not coming together, Marilyn Monroe's jacket, and of course, marijuana or some other chemical aid. The first spell occurs at the opening speech of WordFest after Grady leaves the lecture hall and goes into the atrium. He and James Lear have arrived late because he stayed behind at the Gaskells to show Lear Marilyn Monroe's jacket. He doesn't know yet that Lear's stolen it, but there's still a direct proximity that's there. Furthermore, he has, how does Crabtree put it, staged a rage on the Crabtree pharmacopoeia, having washed codeine down with whiskey. Of course, that's to take a little bit of the bite, no pun intended, off of what Poe has done to him. So Q rattles on with that ridiculous speech.
Mm-hmm.
God, we got to talk about how bad that is.
It's bad.
I am a writer. But he sees Sarah in the auditorium. Michael Douglas does a great job of acting here, by the way. He's so good at not saying anything, but just his facial expressions. Matter of fact, a lot of the cast is. I know we're going to talk about some later. But you can just see the questions and the uncertainties etched in his face. He begins to grow more agitated, and he needs to step out. And as he does, you can hear Q's words audibly in the background. I think that's important. He starts out with that terrible metaphor. What is the bridge from the water's edge of inspiration to the shore of accomplishment? Which makes James Lear cackle. And mm-hmm. should make the entire audience cackle. That's bad writing. Speaking of which, he says then faith. All this is playing as Grady is leaving. So it's in the background. And, you know, and he's kind of about to have this spell anyway. So I don't know that it's even registering with him. But it registers with us if we listen. Faith. Faith that your story is worth telling. Faith that you have the wherewithal to tell it. And faith that the carefully woven structure that you create won't collapse beneath you. So while this, again, isn't the greatest motivational writing, I sometimes think Q is meant to be a riff on James Patterson, who, he's certainly prolific, right? He's the best-selling author of all time ever. But have you ever read anything by him? You ain't missed anything. He just churns it out, formulaic, no editor. So I think Q is kind of, I think I'm taking some stabs there at Q, being James, like James Patterson. But either way, his words perfectly echo what Professor Tripp is struggling with and the insecurities that he's having. Second spell takes place the day after those wild events of that night before. So by this point, Tripp has realized that Monroe's jacket is in Lear's knapsack. And he steps out on the porch wearing that pink robe. It's not in the book at all, is it?
No, it's not.
So there's one thing that they added. So he's wearing that pink robe and he reaches in the pocket and finds a joint and a lighter. So of course he lights it up. And then he comes back in and begins to work more on his novel. Beginning at the infamous page, 2611. It's a big book. The final spell occurs outside Kravnik's Sporting Goods when he goes to retrieve the car that was stolen from him by Vernon, and of course was stolen from Vernon by Jerry Nathan, but that's another story. When he gets inside, he looks in the knapsack and notices the jacket's missing. He then grabs the weed out of the glove box and, of course, the cap gun, we'll put that in air quotes, that James Lear had. Of course, behind him is Hannah Green's borrowed car with Crabtree sitting there, with, again, those three boxes of his manuscripts. All that is, again, right there in that close proximity. In each of the spell scenes, including the onset of the one that never comes at the end, there are some interesting similarities. The same staccato, cacophonous notes play during each. There tends to be blinding flashes of light. And we get the first-person point of view of Tripp as he passes out and comes to. And each of these scenes are also interesting. So the first scene in the lobby of the lecture hall, Tripp stumbles into a corner and looks up at a statue. We get this very interesting low-angle, almost worm's-eye view of the shot, looking up at the statue, which happens to be a mother holding a small child. And interestingly, seconds before this, there's a bird's-eye view shot up above that captures the statue in frame, almost looming menacingly over Tripp. The blinding light overcomes the statue's face and fades to black, and the child sort of disappears. And you catch this scene, it's amazing, isn't it? It just sort of blends into Sarah's face as she's kneeling over him with concern. And Sarah, of course, is carrying his child. So yeah. A little bit of a parallel there. It's almost like they did that intentionally. The second spell is him looking at the pages of his novel that he's writing, and it blurs and goes to black before we are still in Tripp's point of view looking up at James Lear. What he's typing is also interesting. I'm one of the few fools that would actually pause this and write this down. But here is a sentence that begins page 2611 of that infamous book that wound up in the river. Jay smiled and shut his eyes again, and a few minutes later he was asleep. For a while, Harry just sat there on the bed, listening to his father's breathing and to the plaintive machinations of the old Big Ben alarm clock. Then, idly, he reached for the pile of papers that his father had left on the, and here, nightstand is misspelled, I-N-G-H-T stand, spelled this way in the film, and bound by a thick blue R-U, and by the time he gets the U, that's when he has his spell. So he awakes to find Lear standing over him, and again, papers bound by a thick blue, whatever that is. There's three boxes of this manuscript right there. While unlike the first scene, there's no representation of a child, we do have a parental or quasi-parental relationship between both the page, where the father and son are, and also with James Lear as a stand-in for a son who hovers over his own father figure who's asleep. In the final spell, Grady is staring at the cap gun, and the reflection of the sun pushes him into the spell with another bright flash. At first, when he comes to, he's looking up at Ula, surrounded by the pristine blue sky and nothing else. Only a split second later does the harsh industrial urban landscape appear behind her, the beatific vision being brought crashing down. Ula, of course, is also pregnant, carrying Vernon's child. What a great name, too. Ula.
Oh, I know. I love it.
Actually, so funny. What, 2 days ago on my Facebook memories?
Yeah.
A picture of me having a double dickel on the rocks came up and had the quote, "I never forget a drink," and me, "I never forget an Ula." It's almost like I watch this all the time.
Fits her, too.
Yeah, so the chain of events that occurred after this third spell are important, but of course. First, Crabtree hilariously tries to come to Tripp's aid and inadvertently sends the 2,600 pages of the manuscript flying out of the car into the river. Which river?
Oh, that river I can't say.
No, I can't say it.
Yeah.
You cursed me. Monongahela. Oh, I have to cut.
Go ahead. All of you listeners, try to say it right now.
Monongahela.
Monongahela. It's difficult.
I practiced. Where the heck was I? This is worse than me in class chasing rabbits. Rather magnanimously, aren't you surprised by this? After all this happens, Vernon's like, "Yeah, I'll give you a ride back to the Word Fest." So he gives them a ride back, and Vernon asks of the book, because, you know, Grady says, "I don't know what it's about." Vernon says, "If you didn't know what it was about, why were you writing it?" And Tripp replied, "I couldn't stop." So when reminded by Crabtree about the jacket, Grady simply tells Ula that it was once worn by Marilyn Monroe and allows her to keep it. By allowing her to keep it, it's as if the jacket has been sort of given a new life. DiMaggio and Monroe's marriage was ill-fated and only lasted 9 months in total, as well as some accusations of domestic abuse in there. It's probably something we don't want to get into and have time to. But if anyone can make it work, it's those two kids, yeah. Ula and Vernon. They're really in love, you can tell. It suggests they'll be great parents, which is amplified by Vernon's response when Grady says, "Boy or girl?" Vernon says, "As long as it looks like her, I don't care."
So sweet.
Their affection is palpable, and it serves as the model for Tripp that suggests in this moment he's made up his mind. He's going to go with Sarah. He's going to have this child, do the right thing. After the closing ceremony, as Grady searches for Sarah, he feels another spell coming on. This, of course, is when he looks down to see Traxler, and in one final act of letting go, drops the bag of weed. It's a great visual scene, too, isn't it? Very Hitchcockian, those stairs.
Oh, yes, immediately what I thought of, yep.
Again, that same music plays when he's having the spells. We cut to a first-person POV. That one made me gasp the first time, because he sort of like lean over like he's going to fall, and then, of course, he doesn't. So Tripp, think about it, has let go of the book. Well, he had the book gone.
But
it was taken. He's let go of the jacket with all that symbolism. He's let go of the weed. And he's accepted all of his responsibilities, specifically the role of father, and all his other issues fade away. Do I want to go on that quick rant? I don't want to sound like Snoop Dogg before he was America's uncle at the Olympics. But
he has had more side ambitions than any person alive.
He really has. But growing up, I knew him as like a pothead. And I'm not. I don't do this stuff. I don't partake of the devil's lettuce. But I do know, this is one of the few things that bothers me about this film, is just it almost comes off as preachy about the marijuana. First of all, marijuana may cause seizures. We don't really know. There are some studies that say maybe, but they're the same studies that are funded by the government agencies that want to keep marijuana illegal. So it's kind of hard to trust them sometimes. Even those studies, though, say that what marijuana does is trigger another cause for the seizures. It doesn't actually cause seizures at all. So I'm gay for Grady. Gay for him for giving that up. You want to be in your right mind. You don't want that cloud when you're raising a small child. Good for him for not leaning on chemical substances. I'm just saying those seizures are not going to stop. Eventually they're going to come back up and be triggered by something else. He just needs to go to the doctor. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Get a CAT scan or something.
He does need to go to the doctor.
He does. It's just, I'm old enough to remember those, like, Just Say No programs and the DARE programs in the school. They were a joke. They were the butt of a joke. This is your brain on drugs. You probably don't know this stuff, do you?
I don't.
Some of our older listeners will remember, I learned it from you, Dad. So this guy would come in, this kid had a box of drugs, and the guy came in, he's like, where did you get these? And he's like, I learned it from you.
Oh my goodness, like a skit?
Yeah, it was almost like a skit. YouTube it if you haven't seen it. It's so poorly acted, and it's just so, like, you could tell the people who made this are so out of touch with the youth. And a lot of ways, that whole anti-marijuana message or whatever it is here really comes off that same way. Just, I wish it would have been a little less preachy. And it's like that in the book and the film.
It is definitely a huge focus. Like, so much so that it is very in your face. And again, I'm with you as well. I've never done and don't partake in the devil's lettuce. But it was very in your face. Every scene where it was present.
Yeah, it was quite obvious. And it almost like celebrates it in some ways. Kind of wants to have his cake and eat it too, Because it at times makes it look like it's, okay, this is cool to, as Lear says, no one like to lose control over my emotions. And then he does. And then drinks a whole lot of orange juice. I do love that one line where he's like holding the donuts. He's like, do you want one? They're incredible. And he's like, smoke the rest of that joint, James. You can eat the cardboard.
It's funny because Grady needs to go to the doctor. And he looks at James and says, better be careful. There's a lot of acid in that.
Watch your stomach, but I'm having seizures.
Right.
Anyway, before we get any deeper, we should probably pause and take a word from our sponsor, WordFest.
You are a writer, and you know what that means. It's time to dust off those manuscripts, pack up that 1966 maroon Ford Galaxy 500, and head to the literary event of the year, WordFest.
Begin the festivities with the Gaskell's legendary kickoff party, where the conversation is sharp, the dog is friendly, and the greenhouse sparkles like heaven in the distance. But watch your step. Those stairs can be tricky after a few drinks.
Over the years, many a masterpiece has been launched at WordFest. Just think about the unforgettable titles that found publishers here. The Loneliest Frog. The Last American Marriage. And who could forget The Lovely Parade?
Love Parade.
Right, that's the one. Just another example of why editing matters, folks. But lucky for you, Terry Crabtree will also be there, looking for his next bestseller.
Whether you're an aspiring novelist, a seasoned wordsmith, or simply someone who loves the written word, WordFest is a place to be. Rub elbows with fellow scribes, swap stories, and hey, your next big idea might just be a double dickle away.
WordFest,
because in the world of writing, there's no such thing as too many words, just not enough pages. I think 2,611 is enough.
That is so many pages.
So many.
Kind of makes me feel like a slacker, but also kind of makes me feel... like, what are you doing?
We Infinite Jest? Are you Foster Wallace, dude? Come on.
I mean, good for him, I guess. He can say he did it. And so now we move on to our most hated character.
You love this segment.
I do. I love this segment. And I try really hard not to hate a character in a lot of ways. I really do. I try.
Then why do you love the segment so much?
I don't know. My duality, it's coming out.
There you go.
You know, and honestly, in some ways, every character in this story is selfish. I mean, there's a lot of selfishness going on. There were many times where I just thought if they fought for the best interest of each other without thinking about themselves, conflicts could be avoided. But this also just made them very human, right? Made them all make very human decisions, made it relatable, also got you emotionally invested. However, I liked every character for the most part because of their depth and relationships with one another. There was always a moment of like mercy and empathy for each character. Even though she is short-lived, my most hated character is definitely Carrie. Immediately when she mercilessly berates James's story in class, I don't like her because there is a way to express criticisms respectfully. You know, so her attitude was just so unnecessary.
You've never been in a writing workshop, have you?
Just so unnecessary.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and then to call out his, you know, maybe it was his family's origin, maybe not, either way. I just did not like her attitude. Then at the end, her comment about James being like an alien, and we all knew how she meant it, is just so judgmental and uninformed. And maybe she's a good student. Maybe she's a good writer. I don't know. But she could definitely class up her attitude.
Yeah, I agree. I hate her absolutely the worst. By the way, Karis Mikkelsen is her name. Not very many roles at all, but she does a good job. I mean, the actress.
Yeah.
She makes me hate her.
She made me feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to go with Q as well. I just hate him. And I know you talked about him in the book a little, and we kind of understand, but he's just, we all know that person, right? Was it last Thursday? We were at Sweet Basil. We were mentioning this book to a friend of ours who's a writer and a writing professor, and he said, yeah, that makes that book and film, I think you've seen them both, right? So that book and film makes we writers look really bad, and it's also very true. It's like the most real book or about writing or something he said. I say that to say, we all know some of the types of people that this book and film are kind of putting forth, and Q is one of them. We know someone who's self-aggrandizing, thinks he's much more intelligent and important than he actually is, and carries himself that way, will never let you forget it. I also just have to point out with Walter, he's so obsessed with the marriage of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, it's so funny in the opening party scene. He's talking about this to everybody. But you got it. You're like, yeah, he's a scholar.
Yeah.
He's got this one little tiny niche area, and he's obsessed with it, and he talks about it all the time.
Yep.
I know this one guy who's obsessed with animal attacks, does the same thing.
Oh, me too. I know that guy.
He's a pretty cool guy, though. So I guess we'll move into our Enjoy Teach Scholarship. Enjoy, it's a silly question for me. I think I've already fawned over it enough. I didn't mention this, but this book is one of the reasons I chose the career path I did. Not because I wanted to have those same crazy antics, but I don't know, there's just something about it. Just, you understand where these people are coming from and the passion they have for the written word. I get that, even if they are deeply flawed people. I also make sure I rewatch this film at least once every year. I can pretty much quote it verbatim at this point. So safe to say I've enjoyed both.
I also really enjoyed both the book and the film. The depth and severity, like I want to call it severe. The characters and the themes were just, I feel, unprecedented, particularly 30 years ago. And they're still very strong and very relevant now. And the acting, I mean, oh my word, I just cannot get over how good I feel the acting was in the film. When I saw Tobey Maguire, you know, he's Spider-Man. He's in a few other things too. But I just felt he really was a star in this movie. I was so captivated by his performance.
Yeah, he's incredible. The whole cast. I mentioned Michael Douglas and particularly how he acts without saying a word sometimes. Robert Downey Jr., it's worth noting here. I think he'd probably done Gothica, but, you know, he had that time away from Hollywood because he was an addict and was getting arrested and stuff and he had to go to rehab. And this was kind of part of his comeback tour. Mm-hmm. You know, if we didn't have this, we might not have had Iron Man. And I don't know that I want to live in that world.
That'd be sad.
Incidentally, Iron Man, Spider-Man, and Hank Pym.
That's true.
And Rachel Dawes from the Batman.
Yep.
Wow. All those in one film.
And then thinking about teaching, I feel like I would more possibly assign this in a graduate level class, mostly because of how many nuances and critical, potentially controversial topics there are in the book, I do love that the film and book are so similar, because it's sometimes difficult to teach a text and endorse watching the film adaptation during class. Because if you know the film is drastically different, it may jumble memories or analysis of what happens in the plot.
Did you know that the dragon in Beowulf was the son of Beowulf and Grendel's mother?
Yes. Of course.
I get that so
That's the
much.
Answer, yeah.
I almost quit teaching Beowulf altogether because I'm so sick
of that movie.
Stop doing it. I've never taught the novel, but when, if I suppose ever, I get another crack at American Literature Part 2, I'm going to assign it, I think. You know, I always wanted to, if I got another American Lit 2, to teach Jaws, but you and I kind of did that already mm-hmm. with our honors comp class, so. And I want to give Michael Chabon another go. Not that I'm wrangling for an English 222 anytime soon, but if our department chair does listen to our podcast.
I'll clear my throat for that one, too.
Oh, thank you. As far as scholarship, I've not had any opportunity to do any work on this book or film, and I probably never will. The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which he won a Pulitzer for that one. Moonglow, I think this is his most recent. It's so good. They're all top-notch. Maybe if he writes an animal attack book. You know, he sets all these in Pittsburgh anyway, so. Come on, Chabon. Alligator in the Ohio? Or the Monongahela?
The Monongahela.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned Tobey Maguire. He was involved in writing the screenplay for Spider-Man 2 as well, which is, in my book, the best non-MCU comic book movie that's out there.
Ah, yes. I do like Dr. Octopus. I like that villain.
And I don't like Christopher Nolan, so. Cue the hate mail.
Yeah, I couldn't find much scholarship outside of book reviews for this novel. I did do a little bit of a deep dive trying. But when Grady said, "I don't believe in writer's block," I thought about how that is somewhat of a controversy. There are multiple studies both defending that writer's block is real and those claiming the concept is inherently wrong because it implies that thought processes stop. So I suppose the debate is rooted in how you specifically define writer's block, but it is a very interesting question. I mean, I don't have my opinion where I could write it down.
I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in it?
I don't believe in writer's block. I tell my students this too because they'll say, okay, I'm writing blocked. And I know exactly how this is going to sound because of this very film and book. But the cure for writer's block is to write. You just keep writing and you can always edit what you've got on the page. Now, if it turns into 2,611 pages, then you've got another problem altogether. And I think that's kind of the joke that we're getting here. But yeah, I mean, Grady's not wrong. Mm-hmm. You just need to write. You can always edit what you've got. If you're not feeling it, delete it.
Right, or write something random.
Yeah, do something else. Just write.
And moving on, so a lot of this film is very alarming in some ways. Yeah, so really, when I was thinking about a crazy moment that really hooked me, this was the first one, I think, where I was really struggling to come up with a moment for this section. I'm going to talk about more of a cringeworthy moment. when James laughs in the middle of Q's speech, you know, particularly in the film when you're seeing it, I literally gasped. I had some secondhand embarrassment. And then when everyone looks at him, I was like, no, poor James.
Because everyone should laugh. That's a terrible line.
It was awful. And I totally understood why he laughed. But
he was also stoned at that point.
And also the scene where the pages go flying out of the car. I know that in the end, he was writing this crazy long book as a metaphor of feeling stumped in life, but it was still just so, so sad to watch all those years of work, those pages being lost to the wind. I mean, I cannot imagine how I would feel. My jaw was just open.
And you know, at some point, some graduate student would study Grady Tripp and go through that unpublished 2,500, 2,600 page manuscript and have something to do. It'd be archived in this fictitious university he's teaching at right now. Or I don't know, he loses his job, doesn't he?
So, yeah,
or he gets put on academic leave, I believe, in the book. But he says in the film, I straight up lost my job. So much of this film is WTF, and I mean that in a good way. You mentioned the jumping on the car. Just so many moments. And I love films like this. I talked about it in my other podcast with Bridesmaids when they're on the plane going to Vegas. I love when just like all these crazy threads come together to make pure chaos. And one of my favorite moments is one is the hood jumping, because it's sort of the culmination of all that weird stuff going on. But the next morning, when the cop comes by, and, you know, Grady knows that, that Lear's in trouble and that he's stolen his jacket. And then he's like, everything is going wrong. And then Hannah comes out, like, stretching in her red boots. And she's like, Grady, we're supposed to talk. And you can just, and, oh, Sarah calls. Mm-hmm. And that moment, he just hangs up on her. I get it. It's like, I can't take it anymore. But if WTF is something that's negative, you know, I've got two complaints with this film. I already talked about one, that it becomes a PSA against marijuana. I can forgive that. One thing I cannot forgive is when Tripp says Wonder Boy at the end when it's announced the Love Parade is going to be published. It's a pet peeve of mine, but I cannot stand when a film feels it's necessary to shoehorn in the title, or somebody has to literally articulate and utter the title. I didn't need that.
I can respect that.
To be fair, the book, make sure that it says the book he's writing is Wonder Boys. How many times? Like,
oh, a lot.
A lot.
Honestly, this narrative is such a linear, almost autobiographical text that there's no pinpoint climax or rising action exactly. And it's these bizarre conversations, scenarios just keep happening. And I love it. I love organized chaos. It's difficult to pinpoint one moment where I was singularly shocked or engrossed because I was so connected to the narrative the entire time. In the film, I have to say that I literally laughed out loud in the scene where Grady says it's fine that he takes the fall for the dog because he has tenure. I mean, I laughed so hard. And then I had to go back so I didn't miss the conversation where James says, now, that is a big trunk. It holds a tuba, a suitcase, a dead dog, and a garment bag almost perfectly.
You know, just like the ads used to say.
Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, of course, it's incredibly sad that the dog passes. I don't want that at all. But just the way that conversation went, it was so morbidly humorous and just really stuck in my mind. And it's hard for me to actually laugh at something anymore when it happens, especially when you might be watching something on your own. And I did. I laughed really hard at that scene.
Yeah, there's a great irony. I love this film so much, and I hate when dogs die.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
This is just one I have to make an exception because it's so good. I guess my geek out moments, I want to talk about the book for a second, actually. Because like I said before, I love Chapin. His descriptions are so wonderful. He gives all these characters these off-the-wall quirks that feel real, like Hannah Green wearing red cowboy boots everywhere. I love that it's at the Gaskell's party, right, in the film?
Yes. She's
dressed
them.
Up really nicely, and then the camera just scrolls down, and she's got those really out-of-place red cowboy boots on. The film does a good job of capturing some of those, but you have to read Chapin's descriptions in the novel. They are just so, so spot-on and just so descriptive. Mm-hmm. I actually have the book here. I've got to read the one about Sarah. I mentioned she looks very different in the film. So if you've got the, who is this, Random House trade paperback, you can read along on page 34 here. But I love this description. I've got to talk about it. So this is it. Antonia has asked Grady, is she pretty? And Grady, for some odd reason, replies, not as pretty as you. So here's what he says after that. Sarah wasn't as pretty as Emily either. And she had none of Emily's delicacy of skeleton or skittish grace. She was a big woman. Tall and busty with a large behind. And as with most redheaded women, what beauty she possessed was protean and odd. Her cheeks and forehead were wild with freckles, and her nose, although cute and retrousse, I think I'm saying that right, here we are butchering another French word, in profile, had a way of looking bulbous when viewed straight on. By the age of 12, she had already reached her present height and bodily dimensions, and I believe it was a result of this trauma and the demands of her professional position that her everyday wardrobe consisted almost entirely of controlled top pantyhose, plain white cotton blouses, and shapeless tweed suits that spanned a brilliant spectrum from oatmeal to dirt. She imprisoned her glorious hair within its scaffolding of pins, painted a thin copper line across her lips for makeup, and aside from her wedding ring, the only jewelry she generally wore was a pair of half-moon reading glasses tied around her neck with the length of an athletic shoestring. My favorite line, I think, in the whole book. Undressing her was an act of recklessness, a kind of vandalism, like releasing a zoo full of animals or blowing up a dam.
So abrupt.
It's just good writing.
No, and I agree. I think the word choice, the syntax, the imagery overall of this book, it's something that I feel like I haven't read in a long, long time. I feel like it's truly a singular talent to write.
First Chapin?
Yes, my first Chapin.
I got some books for you to read.
He's amazing. I really
got all kinds of free time, so.
Yeah.
Oh, there's some trivia about this that I really want to get into. I've watched this way too much. So there's a lot of stuff here that I see and that I pick out on that's most, I mean, you're not going to catch this the first viewing or probably the 14th. It's just me being weird. But I do want to point this out, a couple of things. For starters, anytime you see this film now, it's going to say it's edited for content. And what's edited is like 3 or 4 seconds. But when Lear is giving his speech about the list of Hollywood suicides, he mentions Alan Ladd, who's best known for films like The Great Gatsby, not the musical one, but the earlier one, and Shane. So in 1964, Ladd was found dead in his Palm Springs home. The cause of death was cerebral edema. He had insomnia, and a lot of times he would mix alcohol with sleeping pills. And none of what he took, he had, I think, 2-3 different pills in his system, and he had alcohol. None of that would have been fatal on its own, but the mixture is what wound up getting him. It was ruled accidental, however, and the Ladd family took issue with him mentioning it as a suicide. But it is fair, like we talked about before, it's lifted straight from the novel. In the novel, you can still see it. Lear says, Alan Ladd, 64 or more pills.
I can understand their opinion and their feelings on that.
I don't know how deep we want to get into it.
Yeah.
Several years before, actually, first of all, his mother had committed suicide years and years before. And then several years before this, he actually called the police and he had shot himself in the ribs. And he swore that he heard a prowl or something and he tripped and the gun went off. But there's a lot of thought that maybe he tried to shoot himself then as well. The Ladd family don't sue us or anything. I'm not saying that's the case. I agree with you. The official death certificate says accidental. So if it says accidental, it's accidental, mm-hmm. right? Can I talk about the poetry for a minute?
Please do.
I love poetry. So if you'll notice in the opening scene when we're in the classroom, there are 2 different chalkboards and there's a poem written on both of them. Of course, I paused this immediately and it was one of the first times I saw it, actually. Paused it, and I was like, what are these poems? I've got to know. So the 2 poems are Shakespeare's Sonnet 12, not one of his more popular ones, and Tennyson's Ulysses, which, oh my gosh, one of my favorite poems mm-hmm. of all time. I teach it every Brit Lit. Both of which deal with aging and the onset of death. I think Ulysses is the most obvious thematically, right? You and I are old. Old age hath yet its honor and its toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming of men who strove with gods. Love those lines. I love that old poem. There's another interesting theme that is perhaps less obvious, but also factors into the film. In Sonnet 12, which is one of Shakespeare's sonnets to the fair youth, the speaker acknowledges that even the beautiful lover will grow old and die, but perhaps through one's descendants, the, quote, virtue and beauty, to use Shakespeare's phrase from the poem, will continue. In the middle of Ulysses, he also transfers the power to his son, mine own Telemachus, to whom I leave the scepter and the isle. So, of course, at this point, Grady doesn't even know that Sarah's carrying his child, but the film does end with the 2 of them as parents, so I think thematically that's a very deliberate choice. So kudos to I don't know if it was Curtis Hanson, the set designer, whoever did that. They knew what they were doing. That was very nice.
One of my favorite things about watching any film that has kind of a literary prowess, professor, classroom teacher, immediately I am ready to look for what they are teaching. Like,
oh, yeah.
What's on the board? What's for homework?
Are there any books anywhere?
Yes, yes. That's some of the most fun, for me, eggs to find in movies.
Absolutely.
For sure. And, yeah, I didn't talk about this in the duality. I could have a little bit, but the aspect of narrating or talking to oneself in both the book and the film, or we get kind of that inner monologue in the film at different points for Grady. And I just think the act of talking to oneself is also very reflective in a lot of ways. We see Grady's inner thoughts, how he's reflecting, and also how we disagree with those thoughts at times. And there's a scene where they're in the bar, right? And at this point, James is really, really loopy. He looks like he might be passed out in the booth. And Crabtree and Grady are talking to each other, and they start narrating Vernon.
Vernon Hardapple.
Right? They start narrating, having these little plot points, describing him. Focus a lot on his hair, which he does not appreciate.
Well, that pompadour is something else.
It was impressive. I mean, I got to hand it to him. And then all of a sudden, James kind of wakes up, and he finishes the story when Crabtree and Grady are stumped.
When a gangster named Johnny Nostrils.
And they're just looking at him with a sense of not surprise, I don't think. I think it's more of a sense of longing and admiration in a way of they're trying to figure out this ending. And immediately James comes into the fold and narrates this eloquent ending to the story that they've begun. And it's just great symbolism for the generations will go on. You know, especially for Grady as a teacher, what you were teaching him and what you were instilling in him, that is also your work and your legacy that's going to be written through his writing because of your influence. And so I really like this idea of narration and talking to oneself in the book and in the film. I also love how Grady says he couldn't tell with James where the page ended with him and real life began. Like, what an interesting person to know. I'm sure it's very frustrating, you know, because how do you know the truth? But that is just prime characterization for James, I think. You just don't know where the story ends and where real life begins.
We still don't.
No, we still have no idea.
Those people that picked him up, were they his grandparents or parents?
I don't know. Maybe they were complete strangers he paid off.
No, it definitely wasn't that. But
it's just...
Yeah, when Grady says, clearly that man looks just like you, and he's like, no, they're not my parents, they're my grandparents. Who knows?
Who knows?
Did his mother work as a fry cook and be whatever kind of dancer they wanted her to be? Who knows?
I have no idea. I'd love to know.
When we fall hard. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's do some more trivia. I know this film so well. See, I haven't seen it so many times. And here's another thing that I did at some point. When they put the combination in for the safe where Marilyn's jacket is, of course, I mean, it shows. You see his finger mm-hmm. punching the numbers in. So the combination is 5641. And my first thought was, oh, that must have been when DiMaggio and Monroe got married. And I went, well, no, it's not. 41, there's no way. So I started digging and digging, like, what in the world? Where does it come from? Well, it turns out we talk about the 56-game hit streak by Joe DiMaggio. It took place from May and July of 1941. So I think that's what it is, not to mention 56, right, games in a row. So I believe that's what it is. I dug in to figure that out. Speaking of that 56-game hit streak, if you are baseball fans, Walter Gaskell gushes at the party that will never be broken. It does still stand. The closest anyone has come to challenging is Paul Molitor in 1987. I remember this. Used to be a really big baseball fan. He finished with 39, so 17 short of the record.
Wow.
I don't think anybody's ever going to break that. I think we're safe on that one.
Definitely now. I did think it was very interesting in the novel how it mentions that all of James Lear's stories are named after old Hollywood movies. The Love Parade is a 1929 film directed by Ernst Lubitsch. I think I'm saying that right. But I think that's really interesting.
Isn't it German?
It is German. I don't speak German. Sometimes I just can't speak.
You're verboten in Germany. We have 2 subscribers in Germany.
Oh, man, I'm verboten in Germany and France, I'm sure. I botched that
just
pretty hard.
Say Estut mir leid. They'll know what you mean.
Estut
mir leid.
Mir leid.
Means I'm sorry.
I do mean it. I do. But yeah, because we see it in the film, especially with the way he cradles the jacket kind of when he first sees it. And it's a passion. I guess that is one of the only real things that we really get to know about him.
He does love old movies and old Hollywood. Speaking of which... In 1998, the jacket, that Marilyn Monroe jacket, so this is before the film but after the book, it was actually sold at Sotheby Auction House to a private collector, we don't know who, clearly it was Walter Gaskell, for $33,350.
That's so much money.
So when Tripp says he doesn't tell Sarah how much he spends on this stuff.
We got a guess for you.
I mean, this was 98, you could have bought a house with that.
Wow.
And then I also found it interesting that Iron City beer is mentioned both in the novel and you see during like the party that Crabtree's holding, you see these cans of it. It's a local brewery. I mentioned before, Chabon loves Pittsburgh, sets everything in Pittsburgh. It is a local Pittsburgh brewery that's been around since 1861. So
I appreciate that authenticity.
As old as the Civil War.
Wow.
About as old as the Atlantic.
Attention to detail. Really have to give it to Chabon.
Chabon and the filmmakers, there's so much detail in this film. I could keep going, but...
I guess that's a wrap-up on our discussion of Wonder Boys.
Oh, no, don't you want to keep talking?
I mean, there is so much that you could really dissect, for sure.
We'll do the sequel, because I want to watch this again sometime soon. No, I'm joking.
And I do hope that you join us next time for a tale about kings and witches and falling stars. And we're going to discuss Stardust next podcast for us.
Cross-dressing sky captains named Shakespeare.
We are going to focus on the 2007 film version, and then it'll be Neil Gaiman's novel in 1999. But we also have some shelf criticism coming up.
Oh, yes, we do. On episode 11, I'm halfway through the first season already.
That's amazing.
So, Sliding Doors, Gwyneth Paltrow, great little film. That's, I guess it's a romantic comedy, but there's some really Sartian existentialism built into it as well. So, this is before Paltrow got weird.
Well, definitely make sure that you go follow Shelf Criticism and Real Lit on social media platforms. If you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Facebook at Real Lit Podcast. And remember, that's Real, R-E-E-L, Real Lit Podcast. You can find us on Instagram, also at Real Lit Podcast. And then you can find us on our website, reallitpodcast.com. Real Lit is an Owls of Palace production. Our executive producer is Reagan Babb. Our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Vahala. For Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. Until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning. Should I start the sentence over?
Yeah, see if you can do it.
Monongahela.
Yep.
Today on Real Lit, we'll be fishing 2,611 pages of Greedy Tripp's book out of the Monongahela because we're analyzing the 1995 Michael Chabon novel and 2000 Curtis Hanson film Wonder Boys.
It's Chabon.
I've been teaching too long this week.